Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Here for another episode of Believe in Kentucky alongside the UK legend, the UK Athletics Hall of Famer, Double Zero himself, Tony Delk. What's going on, TD?
Nothing much, man. I am happy and proud to be here today. Like I said, special moment, man. We have an exciting guest from Jones County.
Absolutely.
Let's welcome in. Absolutely. You know, Georgia's on because I'm in Georgia right now. John T.
John T. Edge
is
here.
Edge.
I gotta get the look. By the time I read the intro of everything he's accomplished, TD, it'll basically be time for him to go. He'll be like,
"I know, man." Time, you know, I didn't want to get into all the things he had accomplished, man, because you know what? When you accomplish that many things, like I said, he has a Schindler list of all of his accomplishments, and that's the one thing I can say about someone who's done that kind of body work for so long and been passionate about it is that, you know, he loves what he does.
Absolutely. So I'll just maybe work him in as we go, but author, host of True South on the SEC Network, and that's what we're definitely going to talk a lot about that. Right. I'm a huge fan of the show, watching all the different cities and towns you go through. And then you went to Brownsville, Tennessee. We're fresh off the Brownsville, Tennessee episode, which is hometown of Tony Delk himself, so we can't wait to get into all that with you right now. So thank you so much for joining us, John T.
My pleasure. Y'all are kind people and generous people, and I'm happy to talk Brownsville, especially with Tony, because I'm new to it. He knows it better than I do. I just showed up with cameras.
Right. And like I said, we just had, you know, just so many phenomenal people, and growing up in that small town, you know, there was so much connection. And even during my middle school, high school, and college, and NBA career, I mean, it always felt great just to go back to Brownsville, Tennessee. And when I tell people, like, where are you from? I'm like 40 minutes from Memphis, in between Memphis and Jackson. And I kind of like, you know, I was kind of putting Brownsville on the map. I'm like, no, dude. People say, oh, you play basketball in Memphis. I'm like, no, I'm from Brownsville. So I was always a homegrown kid that really just loved being there. And when you have, you know, great food. There's still places that I go to when I go back to Brownsville now. You know, there's still Helen's. You know, it's funny about Tripp that, you know, back probably in the early 80s, when my mom was buying catfish. Like, I love catfish. And I never knew where she was getting it from. She was like, I'm getting it from the fish market. I'm thinking like, okay, cool. So I didn't know he was getting this fish from it was fresh like it was. I was like, okay, she's going up there. She's getting fish. And we would cook it like we probably would have a fish fry every Saturday. And that's what made me fall in love with catfish. And like I said, you know, another person that loves his job. And when you're in a small town, and sometimes when people fall on hard times, you still have to figure a way to help those people out. And what usually happens, those people become your friends, you know. So when you go through, I know you've just been going through all these different cities, and, you know, you've come to one of these small towns. We are a community, and when people fall on hard times, we figure a way to help them out.
Yeah. I really heard that from the people in Brownsville I met making the show. And the day after the show ran, so the show ran for the first time on SEC Network last week, and it's done some replays since then. And Larry Davis, who owns that fish market where your mama bought fish, Tony, he told me he ran into Helen Turner in the grocery store. So, you know, and they started talking about the show and what they learned about each other during the show, which
right.
is, it's a perfect small town moment. Like, you know, there are these people who do, I think, heroic things in that town, mm-hmm. feeding people for a really reasonable amount of money,
right.
eating something really good. But recognizing that, you know, not everybody's got a lot of money to shell out.
Right.
And they talk about this as their responsibilities to feed people good food, you know, cheap. And I admire the heck out of that.
And that's and that's the one thing I can always, you know, I tell Vinny when I go back home, you know, there's still certain places that I hit because they have been, they're loyal to the community. And when you can find, you know, store owners, restaurant owners that understand that you have to have a relationship with the locals. You know, it's not about always making money, but it's about having a friendship. You never know, like I say, as I said earlier, people do fall on hard times. And especially during this COVID-19, there were so many families that were stricken by this that, you know, you still have to go and, like I say, you still want to get a good meal. But yeah. in Brownsville, it's going to come at a reasonable price. And even if you don't have it, I can't even tell you how many times probably Miss Helen, Davis, those people have gone in their pockets, you know, just to help other people out. Because what'll happen, it'll come full circle. You're going to get that money back in time. You know, when you do a good deed, I guarantee you, you know, it comes back. And that's the one thing I always loved about when I would always go home is that it made me feel like, you know what, I'm safe in my home, in my hometown. I never felt like I had to go and do anything outside of ordinary or have an entourage of people. My friends that I grew up in elementary, middle school, and high school are still my friends today. You know, still people, I can pick up the phone and call them. They can call me. Even during the height of my NBA career, they would tell you, Tony Duck is still the same person. Nothing changed about me.
Well, that's a great base to have. Like, we both are small town boys. Like, you don't outgrow that, you know, you really don't. You depend on that because you also know the responsibilities you have those people in your small town.
Yeah.
That helps as you grow. It matters.
It does. You know, I think that's the importance about understanding who you are, you know, and I think, you know, the one thing my mom always, she left me with was that be humble, be respectful. And always have a higher power who you believe in. So I just took that motto with me as I, you know, have gotten to my 46 years of life is that treat people the way you want to be treated. You know, when I have my kids, I tell my kids the same thing is that you have to respect people. You know, I tell as I have my basketball academy, I tell the kids, I said, you have to respect the police, the authority. I said, authority can, they can kill you. They can put you in jail. Teachers, they can fail you. I say coaches, they can kick you off the team. They can not play you. I say, and a stranger, they can kill you. So you have to respect that person in front of you because if you don't know them, and even if you do know them, they're a human being just like you are. So don't think you're above and beyond them because, okay, now I have I've gained some fame, I have money and power, is that people can still take your life if that's how they feel and they feel like you have disrespected them. So this is a different generation of kids that we're dealing with, and especially with social media, you know, there's a lot more distraction for them than it was with us when we were growing up.
Yeah, it's true. There's a lot more negotiations to deal with. Yeah. I'm sorry, Vinny, you were trying to say something.
I just got to go back to that before we get off of Larry Davis and the fish market. You know, how you guys, he didn't even know what he's going to do from day to day or how much fish he's going to have to sell, how much fish the fishermen were going to bring in. And even though he had to figure it out daily, he still refused to raise his prices. He said, my prices are going to be the same during this pandemic as they were. So everybody in town could know that they could come there without him jacking up the prices and making it hard for them. So he didn't even know where his next check was coming from, but he wasn't about to stick it to his customers. I thought that was really, really cool.
It was amazing to me too. Like going into that show, I knew Helen really well. I'd known Helen for over a decade, maybe close to 20 years. But I didn't know Larry at all. And Helen introduced me to Larry. I'd stop by Larry's place a few times. I got to drive to Brownsville to get barbecue, and my son and I would. And then on the way home, we'd stop by City Fish Market that Larry owns and buy some buffalo or cat. And then like you know, Tony was talking about with his mama cooking catfish. We'd cook catfish on a Saturday night or buffalo on a Saturday night. But talking to Larry about the way he cares for people and the way he controls the prices, not so he can make more money, to Tony's point, but so he can keep his prices down so everybody can afford them. And the way he controls the supply chain, I'm like, that's sophisticated thinking. Like, listen,
right,
I don't want to have to deal with a meat packing plant in the Midwest that's going to get hit by COVID and the prices are going to skyrocket. I'm pulling everything out of Real Foot Lake, you know, less than an hour drive away from me, and I know what my prices are going to be week to week. I don't know how many catfish I'm going to get. I don't know if I'm going to get big ones or little ones.
John froze up a little bit. Everybody froze.
I'm still here. I got you, B. I'm with you, brother.
That Real Foot Lake, man, I didn't know lakes in Tennessee was kind of marshy and swampy looking like that either.
You know what? I kind of knew it, but it was – you got your back, JT. There you go, man. But you know, but to your point, JT, he didn't price gouge during the pandemic, you know, and that's a – like I said, that's prideful, it's respectful, and, you know, those relationships probably even they grew stronger. You know what I'm saying? Because there were so many different businesses and opportunist people out there that took advantage of the pandemic. And when I heard that, I was like, man, that's Brownsville for you, though. Like, nothing – I can tell you that's the one thing I do love about going back is just that how loyal those people have been for all those years. And what they do is they do a great job of supporting local-owned businesses. And, you know, I know it was restaurants, but I was telling Denny my first cousin, Doug's Body Shop, has probably been in business for, man, 30-plus years. And when you have a local support, your business have a chance to last over time, over decades. Because you think about business now, they might come and go, but when the local people are involved and they're heavily supporting you, is that allows your business to go into your kids, you know, because that's the one thing that surprised me about Helen is that, you know, I know her son, Andre, and I'm like, man, you're not helping your mama down here? But she cooks, like I said, she cooks all day long. And I didn't even know she was, you know, and I didn't know what time she got up, but I'm like, when she would drive, there would be people just waiting on her to drive up, you know, so we can just sit there. And you would have people outside the restaurant, you know, just really just having the casual conversation. I mean, it's just a town like that where, like I said earlier, I feel safe and you can just pretty much have a conversation with anyone that comes up.
That idea of a small town and owning a business in a small town, that's a really important role to play. And it, you know, because in a town like Brownsville, like the agricultural economy is fading and like, you got to figure out your own gig, like Helen and Larry and like your cousin, because the jobs that previously employed people aren't as prevalent now in Brownsville.
Yeah. And even to your point, a couple of factories have closed down. You know, I remember some bigger factories that you know, a lot of people there, you know, like, so you graduated high school, you had a chance to get a good job, you know, in Brownsville. And that left probably 15, 20 years ago. So when we have our high school graduates, you know, I feel bad because I'm like, gosh, there are no job opportunities here. So you have to leave Brownsville. And my mindset, even as I was coming up, I always wanted to live other places. Like I knew I wasn't going to be in Brownsville my whole life. Now, not to say I wouldn't in 20 years maybe go back because it still is home. My mom and dad are buried there, my sister. So it's always going to be a place in my heart for Brownsville. No matter what city I play it in, where I'm living now, Brownsville will always be home.
How did you become familiar with Brownsville, John T? Because like I was telling you before we started recording, I've driven through there once and me and my wife were driving to Dallas, but we stopped in Memphis. I saw the sign on the interstate, Brownsville, and I was like, oh, that's where Tony Duck's from. And then we were driving on through. So what, I know, did you just go for the barbecue? What made you stop there the very first time?
That's enough. I mean, it's that good of a barbecue. I mean, that's the thing about it. And also for, you know, so I live an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes south of Brownsville in Oxford, Mississippi. And that whole belt up there, like Brownsville and Lexington and those kinds of towns, there's good barbecue and has been good barbecue.
Right.
Along that Highway 100 corridor for a long time. So like for me, it was going there the first time on a road trip, loving the barbecue, realizing there was a woman, you know, as the pit master, which was interesting and different.
Yes.
Then getting to know Helen, and she's sassy and funny and cackles when she laughs.
She's real.
And she's tough too. Like, you know, that
she is.
That work is grueling. And so all those things, it became like this place that I wanted to go back to, and became the place now that our son, who's 19 now, and you know, we showed pictures of him in the show, but he took his friends up there. So three college age kids, they all went up to Helen's last weekend. Drove up from here, went to get barbecue sandwiches, turned around and came back. You know,
yeah,
I think they're smart.
Well, no, you know what? It's so funny you say that too, because, you know, as I was stating, like every time I came back from college, that was like my first stop. So it was there. Then I would go to Kmart and I would get some fried chicken. And then I had another spot I would stop by. You know, so I had my three little spots that when I came home that I would stop. I was faithfully stopping there. But, you know, every time I stopped by Miss Helen, you know, we would just actually sit down and I would talk to her because she was always wanted to know, like, how was school going? And, you know, she cared, you know. And that's one of the things about a small town, a community that's tight-knit, is they really care about the kids, you know, especially with me not getting into trouble. And the one thing I just did, I love basketball. You know, I played it all over Brownsville, you know. And I tell people, I say, you know, we grew up poor. You know, we didn't have a car. So a lot of the places I played, I either rode my bike, I had to get a ride with someone, or I walked. And even with my mom, we would go to the grocery store. I think it was wasn't Kroger's, Big Star, and we would stop there. And I tell people the story. I said we had to walk back to the house with grocery in our hand, and I would have to stop because I'm like, Mom, I was probably like 12, maybe younger than that, and I would get tired. So she was like, put the grocery down, put the bags down. We would rest for a little bit, and then we'll start back walking again. And people really, even my kids don't even know. I'm like, you don't even know how poor we was growing up. But, you know, it was kind of like I was poor rich because I had older siblings. So whenever I needed a nice pair of shoes, a shirt, some Air Jordan, when they started coming out, I pick up the phone. I called my seven siblings, and I would get $20 from each of them. So by the time those shoes came out, I had enough money to buy them shoes. Everybody was like, man, how you get the Air Jordan? Because I called my brother and sister. They were adults. They had jobs, and they would just look out for me like that. So it's a little town that every time I go back, you know, I'm always happy to be there. It's a lot different now because, you know, my mom and dad are deceased, but, you know, it was always a point in my life that after NBA season was done, I would always I was so forward looking to going back home, you know, going to the restaurant, seeing my family, seeing my friends. But, you know, it was always great to come home knowing that my mom was going to be there, you know. And I was like, man, so when I go back now, it's a little bit, it's bittersweet, but once again, it's still going to be home because I still have two siblings and two sisters that still live there. Then, like I said, so many friends, you know, we still stay in contact. So during your episode, you know, we all was texting each other. It's like, man, everybody's on the phone like, oh yeah, you remember this, you remember this. So we just going through the episode, but it was so cool that it was about Brownsville and all of us still had a connection. And it's so funny, you know, as I talk about social media, is that we all can be on a device going back and forth with one another.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes me think too, Tony, about the music for that episode. And I wonder if you already knew Valerie June. She was born in Jackson. We used her music. There's this song, Working Woman's Blues, and she's her voice almost sounds like she's from Appalachia, but she's from right there, and she's a black woman singing with that high, lonesome kind of sound.
It's
I love her music. Did you already know her?
No, I didn't know her. You know, the biggest name that our claim to fame is, of course, Tina Turner. You know, everybody's Tina Turner. I'm like, no, she's from Nutbush. You know what I'm saying? But But it's crazy because she went to, I think, Harbor High in Brownsville, and some of the people who I'm still friends with to this day, you know, they know her. They know some of them are her family. And, you know, and I just always grew up thinking, like, man, Tina Turner's from Brownsville. And then I found, like, no, she's from Nutbush. But that's just right, like, 10 minutes away from Brownsville. Yeah. So, you know, we'll claim her, you know, no big deal. Like I said, no one else really knows. But, you know, it's just the connection that we have there. And, you know, even, like, with our sports. Our sports are, like, Friday night lights is just a big thing in Brownsville. It always has been. But that's when, you know, everyone comes out and, you know, we show that local support. And, you know, just that episode, I was like, you know, finally, you know, somebody paying a little respect to the great cooks in Brownsville, Tennessee. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's a pleasure to do. One of the things that we talk about, Wright Thompson, who's the executive producer for the show, we were talking today about our favorite shows to make are about the small towns. Like we've made, I really love making our Memphis episode too, but small towns get you in a different way because you realize that fewer people are paying attention to that place, and you get to pay attention to that place, and you get to tell a story about that place and not everybody's telling. And that feels important to us, and we really love doing it. The episode that we did, you know, in Kentucky, felt the same kind of way, to pay attention to a small Kentucky town.
Right.
To turn people on to those hamburgers, man. Yeah,
Leahy's. Mm-hmm. Leahy's, for sure. I got to ask you, I got to get back to the Memphis too, but just, you mentioned Wright Thompson, which excellent writer, just like you are, and you guys are teamed up together. When the idea for this show, True South, was just a twinkle in y'all's eye, before the creative juices started flowing, how did it begin? Who said what? Who did what to get the ball rolling on this show?
I mean, we've been friends for a good long while, Wright and I have, and we would sit around and have a drink or eat a burger and talk about how we wanted to see a show about the South that looked like the South we know. That wasn't rooted in old stereotypes, that wasn't kind of corny, that looked at the South today, and that we would watch and go, okay, they kind of got it right. And that's a pretty egotistical thing to say, but it's real. Like, we got frustrated by seeing other shows and we wanted to try to get it right. And we also it felt like this moonshot that the SEC network let us take, because when we first started talking to them about it, I thought we would end up doing a show about food and sports. They're like, no, you can go as broad as you want. So we ended up doing a show about kind of food and identity, and sports is a backdrop for it, but it works on the SEC network, and that's the vision of the SEC to let us do it. I'm just kind of stunned and grateful about that.
So, John, have you thought about incorporating the athletes as you go to these different cities, or you just want to keep it on the food side? Because I think that adds a little more interest to it. It's already interesting as it is, because, you know, like I said, I was so locked in with my friend, because I was actually in Lexington, and so I was telling everyone, like, hey, the episode coming at 10, I need everybody to be quiet, sit down, and the TV. So I looked up at the TV screen, and it was just like a blank screen. I said, Trey, are you going to cut the TV on? He's like, no, it's already. But the satellite was a little slow. It was a little bit behind. And so finally, episode came on, and I was in heaven, and I was like, all right, I'm good now. But, yeah, are you thinking about incorporating some other, yeah, other people, athletes, entertainers?
Yeah, I mean, it's varied with each show, but, like, our second episode was Athens, Georgia, and there was James Brown on the sidelines back when he would play on the sidelines and sing Dooley's Junkyard Dogs. And you can see James Brown with his pompadour going right up and down the sidelines. I think we showed Herschel's debut moment jumping over the guy at Tennessee in that show too. So it's varied show to show. We try not to have a formula. So I think we'll end up with more sports figures in the show as it goes. It's good to have the latitude, but just like sports, food's this kind of belief system in the South.
Right.
They've got that in common. I mean, it's the thing we connect over, like your team, your food. It's a part of your identity.
And also, I think when you have, like, you know, athletes or entertainers, especially when they come back to these small towns, you have to wonder, like, where do they eat at? You know, and, yeah. and that's the one thing where, you know, I had my three or four places, but my mom was an unbelievable cook. And my sisters, you know, it's funny you said Miss Helen's a grill master. Like, my sisters had gotten so good at barbecue that I would just come home and they would just grill for me. So, but a lot of that was learned from my mom, right. you know, who also was, you know, she was on that grill. And I started taking some lessons from my sisters because, you know, she would get up every holiday and she would start grilling around 4:30 in the morning. And I remember I was down in Memphis. I just left. I was actually just coming back from gambling. I was in Mississippi. And it was an early morning, so I dropped my friends off at the house, and I got there. It's probably like 4:30 or 5, and my sister was already bringing out the charcoal. And I'm like, so this is how you get started? You start this early in the morning? I didn't even know what time she got started, but I knew by noon everybody was eating barbecue. But, yeah. you know, and so she had a little method that she went by. And then even as I started watching her, because one morning I decided to stay out there. I just started watching her and helping her, seeing how she prepared the meat, you know, and just how long she kept the meat on. You know, she was like, you can't constantly keep turning the meat. You got to go away. But it's hard when you first start to watch your food and not want to flip the meat over. So as I was cooking the first time I grilled, I had the little small red grill, the one you go by at Walmart. Yeah. And I poured a whole bag of charcoal. I'm like, man, you know, I'm going to cook this meat. When I tell you I had a fire about 4 feet high, I was on my way to the house to go get the, I had to go get some water. I'm like, man, I'm about to set the apartment. Actually, I was in a town. I'm about to set the whole complex on fire. And finally I got that fire down. And, you know, so it's kind of like the first time you start, you know, you have to keep, it's like shooting a free throw, repetition. The more you do it, the better you got at it. So I eventually upgraded to a better grill, and yeah. then I became patient. Like, when I put the meat on, make sure that, you know, it wasn't too hot, and then I kind of walked away. So that's the one thing, the patient part was kind of difficult in the beginning.
I got to say, you know, you mentioned how, you know, you just wanted to portray the South correctly when you went to these places. I'm from Harlan County, Kentucky. So everybody watches everything critically. I know Tony watched this Brownsville episode with a critical eye. When Justified came out, you know, I'm watching it, and it, you know, they mentioned in towns and communities from home, but then I'm like, look, there's not that much shooting and killing that goes on in Harlan County, Kentucky. I'm like, they do not have that right at all. We're not just walking. It's not the Wild West. We're not just blasting each other. And it's just, so that wasn't right. And then I just got to where I can't even watch it, man. That's not how it is. So you made sure you portrayed the cities and towns properly and not stereotypical, and you didn't get all kind of crazy with it.
We tried. I mean, we get a lot of things wrong too. I mean, I'm sure Tony could say, well, that's not the way I see Brownsville, or right. You miss this thing or you miss that thing. And I think we miss a lot, but I do think, to your point, Vinny, like, we're trying to sidestep those stereotypes. We're trying to see beyond, and we're trying to be open ourselves, because, you know, I grew up in Georgia. I now live in Oxford. Wright grew up in Clarksdale and now lives in Oxford. We both have traveled the South a lot, but we don't know everything. And when we go to a town, we try to listen to the people in the town and come without preconceived notions, but just listen. And a story should evolve that way. And that's not too much to ask of no. us. Like, you know, that's like, it's exactly what we're supposed to do, is to listen.
And I kind of wish, go ahead, Ben. Go ahead, you got it.
I just had a couple more real. How did you go about picking the cities and towns you were gonna go to? And then how'd you decide what people you were gonna visit once you decided what cities and towns you were gonna go to?
I mean, it's basically Wright and I argue. I mean, basically, we'll come up with a roster of possibilities, and it's not really an argument, but though, like, the food has to be unimpeachably good. but there has to be a bigger story. Like, so Brownsville, if Helen had been there and Larry had been there and we'd had fish and barbecue, it's a great story. But for that minefield to be there and for it to be about somebody's vision in a town that, as Tony and I were talking about, is changing. It used to be an ag town. Now it's become something else. Mm-hmm. Becomes a bigger study in what a small town can be. And that's what makes the show. It's like, if there are two stories here on each side, there's a story about barbecue, there's a story about fish. In the middle, there's a story about identity, there's a story about something. Once we figure out what the middle is, then we know we have a story. And it's just, you know, it's sitting around talking. That's the fun part. It's the part I value so much, because we're looking for good food, we're looking for good people. We're also looking like, what story can we tell each other about this place? And that sounds kind of gushy, but that's kind of it.
So when both of you are like sitting there brainstorming, is that, you know, he might pick a city and let's say a small town in Tennessee, you might pick a small town in South Carolina. So do y'all have a coin flip on where y'all gonna go, or y'all just say, hey man, I'll go your place, you go mine? How do y'all figure this out?
Everything's consensus. Like, we both got to agree. You know, okay. It's and then we'll take a scout trip. So I'll come up with a roster of like, here are six places, and we'll go visit them. And we bring the director along too, Tim Horgan, and we go scout them ourselves. And I'll tell them, here's what you can expect. This is the places we're going. And, you know, they'll have input too and say, you know, I don't see visually how this is going to work, or I don't understand how this story will translate on TV. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of workshop it on the road as we travel.
I think what also helps is it's so authentic. You know, when you can get something that's authentic, it's not scripted, people can really relate to it. You know what I'm saying? Because it's real life. When you, it's not like you watched a movie, like you went into someone's life. Like, that's what they do. It's part of like my, you know, it's like your upbringing almost. When you see something that they're passionate about, it's like, it's not like we're writing a movie here. Like, you know, it's a real life event for them, because they've been living it. And even the people that come in, it's their life too. Because if you've gone to the fish market, you're going to Helen's, I'm sure you're going on like probably hundreds of times. And even if you were to walk in and see a team of producers and cameras, is that, you know, you don't even think about it. This is routine to me. So I like the authenticity of it that makes it real. And it's easy for people who've seen it with their eyes. We can relate to that, especially in a small town. I think you bring light to small town for people who live in the city.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. There's a responsibility. I mean, I kind of used that word a minute ago, but like somebody like Larry Davis, like, I don't think he'd been on television in that way before. And we had a real responsibility to him to help him feel comfortable, to tell his story in the best way possible, to help people understand how important the way he cares for people is. And that took him trusting us too. And that's a lot to give to a goofy kid like me, you know, comes busting in your place saying, I want to tell a story about you.
Right.
It takes a lot of trust on his part.
It does.
I know we can't keep you much longer, John, but I'm going to squeeze a couple more in, John C.
Sure.
I text Tony after the episode played about Brownsville. And I told him that, you know, you did an episode about Memphis. And I said, you was riding around with 8-Ball and MJG, and you went to Orange Mound. So just what was that like, going to the hood in Memphis?
Going to the mound, as they call it.
Yeah.
I'm just happy you're here to tell the story, man, to be honest with you. Most people don't know, but we're going to get into that, though.
They were a great lesson in this, too, because they have great pride in Orange Mound.
Yes.
And wanted people to see their Orange Mound, you know, that's not obscured by all the myths of Orange Mound, not, you know, a story not about violence, a story not about crime, a story about Orange Mound, the people who live there, the people who eat there, the people who cook there, the places they grew up, you know? And it was like watching them being little kids driving this big old Escalade, right. You know, revisiting the place from which they came, you know, and the way they talked about it sounds a lot about the way you talk about Brownsville, like the place that made us, the place we grew up. We've got, you know, it's it's still in our head and our heart, no matter how old we grow up to be, you know? And they were that way. Like, they love Orange Mound, and they grew up blocks from each other. And they got to go back to their own hometown. We just said, you know, we'll get you over here if y'all drive us around around Orange Mound.
And like I said, and it's so funny. Like, you know, they were one of my favorite groups growing up because, you know, I really try to represent, you know, the state I come from when those artists come out. But, you know, you know, I remember my cousin lived in Orange Mound and, you know, just stopping in. And, you know, you hear all these stories. You know, I remember growing up, my mom was like, she didn't want me to go to Memphis. She was like, you can go anywhere, but you can't go to Memphis. And I was like, okay then. But, you know, as a kid, when someone tells you can't do something, you want to go see what it's about. You know what I'm saying? So I was like, I got to go see what Memphis is about for myself. And, you know, I had a great time. Every time I've been to Memphis, I've had a great time. And I tell people, I say, you know, safety is where you go and who you're with. You know what I'm saying? So don't ever get it misconstrued that, you know, something can't happen to you because you're in a nice neighborhood. I said, you got to know where you're at and who you're with. So I always felt safe when I'm with the right people because, yeah, I'm not from the area, but they still embrace me because of who I'm with. And, you know, that episode was just fun because I've listened to so many songs of those guys and, you know, kind of like they poured everything into a song, everything into an album. And when they go back, you know, they just represent Memphis. When you say, you know, 666 Mafia, you say all these different groups from Memphis, is that we'd be like, okay, all these guys come from a tough area, but they were able to get out of it. But still, we all like to go back to hometown. You know, you think about 8-Ball, the only thing I think about is those dudes represent Memphis, man. They represent Memphis to the fullest, and even from the Penny Hardaways. It doesn't matter who come from Memphis, it's still going to be home because everyone had a struggle. You know, even me from a small town, is that there was a struggle at some point in time, but you never take your eye off the big picture. And that is, you know what, I believe in myself and I know I can get out of this situation. And I surrounded myself with the right people that, you know, they held me accountable.
Yeah,
absolutely. Tony, man, I gotta just brag on John T a little bit, read a little bit of his resume before we let him go.
No, you don't.
Yes, you did, man. Let's get to it, man. Get this man his flowers right now.
He wrote a book called The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South in 2017. Questlove in 2018 listed that as one of his top 10 favorite books to read. He recently referenced the book again in an interview in Rolling Stone about how, you know, soul food, I love it, but it's killing me. So I got to stop eating it and I'm losing all this weight. And he referenced John T's work again. He's also been on CBS This Morning. He's also been on Iron Chef. Me and my wife love some Iron Chef, so I need to go back and find that episode where you were on there. And just one more question, too. Like, when you're on a show like that, or if you're judging Chopped or Top Chef or something like that, when you get to that level of expertise that you all have with food, and say, if Jeffrey Zakarian set a plate of food in front of me, I'm going to eat it and enjoy it. They eat it and say, the sauce was a little bit too thick. Is it even fun to be that critical of something that delicious?
I mean, it's play. Like, if you're on a set, like the only one I've really done multiple times is Iron Chef. And everybody there is playing. Like, it they're taking it seriously, but they're also kind of laughing at themselves at the same time. Okay. You know, it's a big experiment. They're doing something ridiculous. They're cooking this beautiful food in 60 minutes, and they really do it in that period of time. But it's like theater, you know, and they're all having fun. And that part of it, I'm doing the same thing. Like, I'm taking a bite of something, and it's wordplay. You know, it's like, what's the funny thing I can say or that's accurate, that's not making fun of something, but how do you be playful? And that's a good gig. You know,
I don't want to put you on the spot, you know, and say what's your favorite restaurant, but just give us a couple of foods that you really enjoy eating. You know, if you had to come down, if you say, hey, you got to choose two or three meals to eat the rest of your life, what would those two or three meals be?
Wow. I love hot water cornbread.
Ooh, okay.
Y'all know hot water cornbread?
But Okay. Yeah, definitely happened.
So for people who are listening to this, don't know hot water cornbread. It's basically cornbread made with boiling water or near boiling water into the dough, oftentimes cooked either like a hoe cake flat or like a fist of cornbread. And it's got a creamy center and the outside's usually crunchy and crispy. I love that style of cornbread. And there's a place in Nashville I love called Silver Sands. Theo Vaughn runs it.
That episode.
It was in our Nashville episode. She's an amazing woman. If you ever get to Nashville and it's lunchtime, she's open every day but Saturday for lunch. I just love that taste. I love that outside exterior and that creamy interior. Love it. And the other thing I crave all the time is greens, any kind of greens, especially mustard greens, like mustard greens.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
There's a place in just outside of New Orleans in Kenner, like when you're coming in from the airport, that's Kenner. And it's a place called Hearst Family Restaurant. It's been open since like 1939.
Oh gosh.
And Felton Hearst is the father, and he makes the best greens I've ever had. He uses pigtails and hocks, and he uses like three different greens. There's a lot of mustard in them. They're remarkably good. Those are my favorite foods.
Okay.
Greens and cornbread.
Okay.
Barbecue. I like that.
Can't go wrong with those at all.
Yeah.
One more thing, Tony. John T is the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance. So I just got to ask, two-part question, you know, book, this show, the director of the Alliance there at Ole Miss, what are you most proud of as far as your accomplishments? I know you're going to accomplish more things. What are you the most proud of? And will we see True South come to Netflix anytime soon so we can just bend it?
It all fits together. Like, the reason I'm doing this show is because I've been doing Southern Foodways Alliance work and writing work for a long time before that. Like, I learned how to do this show when I didn't even know I was learning how to do this show.
Wow.
So it all connects up. Right now, the thing I most love doing is this show because it brings all that together. The Southern Foodways Alliance work, like, we've been doing oral history work. In other words, going out and interviewing old guard pitmasters and fried chicken cooks and the like for 20 years now. And, you know, we did a film about Helen a decade ago. We did oral histories with Helen a decade ago. It all adds up to get to where we are now.
Right.
I love telling these stories, and I love telling stories of the South. I'm proudly from the South. I'm also often very critical of the South because, you know, to be critical of your people is to want more out of your people in your place. And I think that's important. It's an important responsibility. I want to keep doing more of this. I want more people to see it. Netflix, Hulu, you know, any of those kinds of platforms would be good. But I have to say, man, you know, SEC Network took a chance on this show, and it's
right.
You know, that's real vision, and I've got real allegiance to the network for that and to the conference. So I want more people to see it, but I love where I am. It's a good place to be.
Great, great job.
So up next is Columbus, Georgia. I've just finished with Brownsville, on to Columbus, Georgia. So definitely can't wait to see what's in store for that one.
There are three words: jerk fried chicken.
Ooh, okay.
Okay then.
Yeah.
I'll be sure to tune in. Columbus is not far, and when there is a good meal, I'm like yourself, I will drive, trust me.
All right, good.
Yeah,
y'all been so generous. I really enjoyed the conversation with y'all.
Yes.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
We appreciate you, and maybe love to have you on again down the road sometime if there's
something. Of course.
Thank you so much, John T. We really appreciate it.
Thank y'all very much, Vinny. Thank you, Tony.
Take care.
All right, y'all too.
John T. Edge, SEC Network. True South, fresh off the Brownsville episode, TD.
That was great, man. Like I said, just getting a chance to relive my childhood. You know, sometimes I forget it. As we get older, you know, you have memories, you reflect on certain things, but when someone actually go to your hometown and then you can actually see them on TV, it's real, you know, because I never thought as a young kid, you know, where I was going to be 10, 15 years, you know, playing basketball. Like, where was this game going to take me, man? I'm doing all this walking around, riding my bike, man, getting chased by dogs. I'm like, man, is it worth it? You know what I'm saying? Like, you're young, you really don't even think about it, man. You know, playing basketball in the sun, you know, and it's just like going in the house with dirty clothes, you know, to the point where you couldn't even come in the house to take your shoes off, your socks, your shorts. And, you know, I'm just like, man, all this for basketball? But like I said, I loved it. And you love something, man, you give it your all.
Absolutely. So we had to pivot for a little bit. You know, we, of course, we're going to be here all season. Our cats are struggling. They're 1-4. But we had to pivot and hit with John T first because, you know, we had to do that. But 1-4, man, as the worst halftime deficit Saturday against Notre Dame, down 22, the biggest halftime deficit in the history of Rupp Arena. They lose by one, come back in the second half. But what's going on?
You know what? I still think it's a chemistry issue, and then it's just trying to figure out who's going to make the game easy for someone else. You know what I'm saying? I think it's you know, and I don't want to blame AAU for everything that goes wrong with 18-year-old kids to come in, because the first thing we point to, oh, man, AAU, they play all these games, AAU, but you still got to learn how to play basketball the right way. And, you know, when you have so many talented players who've never really played together and who've always been, you know, the go-to guy, the guy that can take any shot, you know, and be in position where they can help a team win, now they're just really trying to find each other, man. They don't really know each other. You know, to me, it's like a really good high school team going against college players right now. And when you have assistant coaches, their job is to go out and scout players and take their strength away from them. And I think a lot of times in high school, because you're so talented, you get away with a lot of stuff. You get away with some bad habits. And until you make that adjustment, is you're going to struggle for a while. You know, in previous episode, my first year was a struggle, man. I was like, gosh, you know, when I just annihilated high school players and I got to college, I was like, man, it's hard to get 5 points. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, man, I average 38 points a game. I'm like, dude, I'm gonna make this transition. I'm gonna be averaging. But once again, you know, it becomes a thinking man game. Now it's about IQ. Everybody's talented, athletic, and can you outthink that person that's in front of you? Can you outthink the coaching staff that's been watching hours of game footage on you? You know, and they're giving that opponent an edge. They're giving their players an edge on how to guard your team, how to guard you as an individual. And then that's when, like I said, you know, you got to be able to make adjustments. And like I said, make plays for other people. But when you don't know, when they cut your strength off, what to do, you see struggle.
Now that leads me to, you know, Cal is, you know, his press conference, call-in show this year, last year, year before, you know, we got to fight. You're kind of harping on that fight. Was that something that was harped on when you were on the staff with Harrelson and them, or is it just the thing that's more recent? Is it, do kids now these past few years not know how to fight or be tough, or?
I think it's vice versa, man. When you play so many games, is that, you know, if you lose an AAU game, you got another game coming. You know, like I said, it's a mandatory 3 to 5 games you're gonna get. So you lose one game, and before you know it,
because they just, you know, getting pushed around, getting bullied, and, you know, and he keeps talking about fight, fight, fight. And I just wonder, is it just the kids is recruiting, or is it a problem just, you know, not trying to bash these kids now, but I don't know.
I don't think you bash these kids, because, like, at the end of the day, you know, even though kids might reclassify as I just think not having a preseason makes a huge difference, man. When you have months to really work with someone, you come in, you know, you also not only practicing, you get a chance to play pickup basketball. And when I was there, even as a coach and even as a player, you know, former players would come back, you know, so now you get a chance to play against those pros, and those guys are getting you ready for collegiate basketball. And then you can kind of figure out, okay, man, what I need to work on. And then, like, you know, I remember Rex and Kenny Skywalker, those guys were telling me, because I was curious about the NBA. Oh, man, you got to work on this right here. Oh, okay, so during the season, I'm going to work on this. And I knew it was going to make me a better player, and I really studied the game. I think what these kids are not doing a lot of, and, you know, as I train kids and talk to kids, they do not watch enough basketball. And I'm not talking about just no highlights, like, oh, I'm going to watch a player dunk and go between his legs and all the flashy plays. You have to watch a game from start to finish. And just think about this, V. How many kids do you think can just sit there and watch a whole game from start to finish?
The attention span isn't what it used to be for as far as it goes, is it?
No. Because they got their phone. They like it's their phone, okay? All right? And then next thing you know, they get up. They're gone. I'm like, dude, we talking about watching the Super Bowl, and kids not even watching the Super Bowl. I'm like, oh, it's not only the most watched game in the world. How can you get up and walk away if you said you love that sport? And even for us who might not love football, is that, you know, we all try to watch, you know, the Super Bowl. So that's what I'm saying. Like kids have gotten away from really being a real student of the game, and that's not trying to cheat through how to improve and how to get better, instead of watching and learning, seeing it with your eyes, being visual. And then in your mind, like even with myself, I would just process, what would I do in that situation? Okay, man, you know, shot clock winding down. What spot I need to get to on the floor? Who I wanted to set the screen? I'm already envisioning, like, what's going to happen when we get to that point. Now, if we never get to that point, then cool, I'm fine with it. But if it ever happened, I know where I need to get to, who I need to pass the ball to. Like, I'm always thinking outside the box. And it's hard for not all the generation, but some of the generation, because it's like so many things have been scripted for them, organized for them. So they really had to really just be a director and organize something for themselves and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to take responsibility for this. Like, okay, call on the team. Like somebody, let's say who, I don't know who the leader on the team is, but what if their leader decides, hey, man, I'm going to call a team meeting. We need to sit down and kind of figure out what we're going to do the next 5 to 10 games. What we're going to do the next game. Like, what's our plan? So now when I start talking to these guys, we need to some kind of way be on the same page, because if I'm thinking one thing, you're thinking another, and this person's thinking something else, another person, like, you got too many different thoughts going on. Mm-hmm. But collectively, we need to figure out how can we all get on the same page. And I think that just there's a disconnect right there from, you know, the players that are the elite players, supposedly, the players that are there, and no one really knows their role. So it's like they don't have an identity.
Mm-hmm. And the coaching staff is just searching. I heard Cal said that normally the scouting reports aren't that extensive, because he said, we don't want to overwhelm them with a lot of information. But he's like, maybe we need to give them harder scouting reports. Maybe he's even looking at that. Maybe we need to give them more stuff, because maybe what we're doing isn't working. So I don't, you know, so they're even like looking at every little detail of what they're doing, because the stuff he's been doing for the past few years, look, I just want my team to worry about us more so than the scouting report on the other team. That's been Cal's deal all these years. But now he's like, well, maybe I need to thicken up the information in this scouting report. So they are like, they're like no leaving no stone unturned as to searching for what they can try to do to get this fixed.
But I think they got, like you said, man, it's trying to figure out how to get these guys motivated from start to finish, and not have them lose interest, not get down by that many points, knowing that, you know, you had a chance to win the game, but think about all the mistakes you made in the first half, how hard you didn't play, you know, and whether it was an early game or not, that team had to play early too. So I hate when people make an excuse, well, it's an early game, they don't play well. Do you think the other team, they didn't play early? You know, you're not playing against yourself. But also understanding what I need to do to help my team. What is my job? What is my role? And it takes a few games really for a coaching staff to figure out what do you do well? And we're not talking about what you do well at practice or what you did well in high school. I don't care about that anymore. Like, that got to be behind you. Like, what you did in high school, like I said, that's in high school. You got to move past that. How can you impact the collegiate game when the game is a little bit faster, you're playing with better players, the scouting report, they have a scouting report on you now. So you're not a mystery when you come in, you know, you playing against the opponent. Oh, you know, he's really good going right, but he is like a 20% shooter going left. They know that. So I'm taking your tendencies away from you. And you have to have a mechanism in your head that's instinctive. You know, you don't want a robot out there. You know, it's great to give a team a game plan, hey, we're going to execute this. But what will that coach, when he makes an adjustment, how are you going to adjust? That's the basketball IQ, and that's the instinct that kids struggle with because they really never had to deal with it. It's like, okay, everything has been good, good, good. How do I deal with adversity? So what they're going through right now is some adversity, and you're going to see how they come together. And then the coaching staff got to, you know, just got to keep putting game plans together to figure out, like, where's this team at? Where they're going to be, and when March roll around, you know, you want to hope that we've seen Cal team, you know, elevate their game, you know, get better, intensity levels better. They have a better understanding of who they are. They have an identity, and that might have to come earlier with this team because the way the season's going, how the conference is playing, it's going to be tough in conference, man. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be no cakewalk.
Yeah. Now, you know, people listening to this might think I'm being overly negative. I'm just trying to be real. Kentucky, you know, second half, they, you know, come out down 22, start the second half, they outscore Notre Dame 37-16. They end up losing by one, of course. Notre Dame's a veteran team, but they only had seven scholarship players. They have kind of faded down the stretch, I think, against Michigan State, you know, games where they haven't been able to finish and close it out. Was it the combination of Kentucky playing hard and really digging in, or was it the fact that Notre Dame was a little bit thin and had a short rotation and kind of got a little bit tired? Is it a little bit of both, or is it a little bit – what are you chalking up to?
When they were saying Notre Dame, I'm like, man, they have a really good football team. That's all I was thinking about. I knew their football team was going to be good this year. So, you know, I kind of looked at the Georgia Tech game. You know, they had lost to Mercer and Georgia State. So I'm like, you know, this will get us back on, you know, back on track. And I didn't know a lot about Notre Dame. But, you know, when it was funny because I was actually in E-Town, Elizabethtown, and I walked into this place where I was doing a signing. And I was like, hey, what's the score? They said, we're down 24, like 22 or 20 something at halftime. And I was like, man, get out of here. To Notre Dame, like, are we playing a football team on a football field? Like, that's the only way I thought we was going to be down by that many points. Seriously, I'm not even joking around. I'm like 20. So then when they told me the halftime margin, I really thought we was on the road. I can't even lie to you. And they said, no, we're at home. And you should have seen the look on these Kentucky fans' faces. Like it was we've never seen that kind of margin on the floor. Like, I can't even – during my time – I can't ever remember us being down by that many points at halftime. I'm not talking about to a good team, to a team that's okay. So mm-hmm. It would be different if you were down to a Gonzaga, who is really good. They have three future pros on their team. So you can look at it and be like, okay, talent-wise, you know, hey, those guys are better than us talent-wise, but not Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. So it just let me know that they wasn't ready to play right away. And when they finally decided to turn it on, you know, they just ran out of time. But that's a learning lesson to let guys know you're not good enough at this point to take your eye off anyone and think just because we're playing this team and they're not ranked that we should beat them. I said, no, man, you got to understand, like, people take playing Kentucky, they treat that like a Super Bowl, and especially when you can come into Rupp Arena to your home. Like, you must always protect your home. And they didn't protect their home.
Yeah, yeah. So UCLA this Saturday in Cleveland, then at Louisville the next Saturday, and then conference play, like you said. So,
Hey, man, we used to have this right around Christmas time. I don't know if they're still going to do it, but we used to have dedication week. And during those 5 to 7 days, you know, we would definitely get better in that time. And Cal would normally not schedule games, especially when you got a when you have a young team like this and you're off to such a bad start, you probably need, when school is out, about 5 to 7 days where it's just practice, chemistry, going out, eating together, building that for the 2021 season, and knowing that you still have, you know, a couple tough non-conference games. But then when you get into conference, you got to be ready to play. Like, there ain't no taking no nights off. Like, you got to come into conference ready to play first game. And I think, I don't know how you send the message, because once again, we're dealing with a young team. And this is probably one of his youngest teams. And no experience returning. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard for, you know, one player to lead another player when, you know, everybody is coming in at the same. So there is no leader. So now you just can't win with talent right now. You got to win with some guys that know how to play basketball. So, you know, that's where there's a separation between talented players and players with a basketball IQ.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the flip side, the women are undefeated, and Kyra Elzy is no longer the interim coach. She is the head coach.
So I was just waiting for that. You know, Kyra, an intelligent woman, someone I really enjoy working with. She knows the game extremely well. She learned so much from Coach Mitchell, and I'm just happy that she's getting her opportunity, you know, and that's really big for her, not only, you know, becoming a head coach, but, you know, just a Black woman that's passionate and loves the game. You know, she's giving her all to basketball, and you know, she's finally getting rewarded. You know, not only rewarded for, you know, just because, you know, Coach Mitchell stepped down, but at some point in time, you know, she was going to be a head coach. And why not be a head coach with someone you've been assistant coach for, you know, a few years? And, you know, they have a really good team. And then, like, so now, you know, and here's the thing too, Vinny, she's recruited most of these girls. So she has a great relationship with these girls. And it really helps as you go out recruiting, when other recruits can come in, and the first question I would ask, hey, how do you like your coach? How's your coach? So I would know if there's a place I want to go. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Because if she's cool, she understands the game, she pushes us, she's competitive, is that you're going to take on the personality of your coach. And she's a fiery coach because, like I said, who she play for? Pat Summitt.
Yeah.
So, and we know how fiery she was. It was like, man, you know, she had those eyes that if you didn't play, you know, those eyes could look through your body. she can see your soul. She can see your thoughts in your head. You know, she was, like I said, an ambassador for women coaching because of how fierce she was on the sideline, but her approach to the game, you know, so she instilled that in all her players. And that's one of the reasons why most of them have become really good coaches.
Absolutely. I got a message from Matt Moderno. He hosts the Believe in Wizards podcast with Larry Hughes. And before you came on, Matt was the first guest ever to be on this podcast. I was doing a few episodes by myself. Matt came on. We talked NBA. We talked Kentucky. We talked Wizards. He sent me it was actually the Ringer NBA show, and Kendrick Perkins was on there. We asked him, you know, who kind of showed him the ropes when he first came in. And he said Walter McCarty, and he said Tony Delp. When my first year in Boston, they were the ones that kind of take me and show me and help me. So he mentioned you specifically by name on the podcast. So he sent me that, and so I had to, you know, pass it.
That was my young dude, man. And you know, and as I see him being an analyst now, I never would have thought he'd been an analyst. You know, of all the things Big Perk is doing right now, I'm like, Big Perk, man, you're supposed to be on somebody's sideline being a bodyguard to someone. But no, but you know what, I tell you what, he really learned the game though. You know, he got a chance to see it, you know, from, you know, towards the end of your career, you really can learn a lot, you know, because you're not playing as much, and you know, you kind of watching how things move and just how the game has changed. You know, because when Perk came in, you know, came straight out of high school. So we really had a good thing going in Boston. and we played hard. We competed. We understood each other. And when you get a chance to have veteran guys that teach you the game and teach you how to be a professional, like that's the most important thing, is that even as I built my TDBA, Tony Hawk Basketball Academy, is that, you know, I teach our kids, I'm like, man, you know, carry yourself in a way that represents you and your family. And when they see someone that's qualified, not someone that's second guessing. And although, you know, you're gonna kind of figure some things out and make your mistakes. But even with Perkins, you know, he really understood, like, how am I going to stay in this league? Because you can be in the league and out the league in the same year. And I've seen guys where they wasn't focused. They were just happy, well, I made it. And I'm like, no, dude, you really ain't made it until you can turn it into a career. Like, 1 year is a few months. Wow. That's like I said, a cup of coffee, a cup of cappuccino.
Yeah.
Come on. It leaves you. So you have to be focused. And it's much harder when you're 18. So I commend him, man, for coming in, listening to guys like myself and Walter, because I wanted these guys to have a career. You know, I wasn't a selfish player that only cared about me. I was like, man, I got to share some of this knowledge with them because someone shared it with me.
Exactly. A couple more quick things, man. First, the sad note, glad to hear that you're doing better, but Keontae Johnson at Florida passed out on the floor Saturday against Florida State. Florida, the team, it had a lot of COVID issues. Was it cardiac? He was in a coma, medical coma for several days. Transferred him back to Gainesville. He was talking earlier today, but that was just, you know, people our age, you immediately thought Hank Gathers, man.
Yeah, it was scary. And as soon as I heard that was the first person that came to mind was Hank Gathers. Hank Gathers, Reggie Lewis, you know, players that I grew up watching, because I was a huge, when I tell you, huge Loyola Marymount fan, man, I love their style. And, you know, seeing Hank go down and, you know, it was tough, man. Mm. And, you know, it was scary just to watch him, like I said, such a great athlete, potential first round draft pick, but a collegiate player that's young. I mean, and you don't think in terms of like, man, you know, I'm gonna collapse, or you know, this is gonna happen to me. We feel like at that age we're invincible, but it was a reality check. I was surprised that they played the game, because I think I would have been so dramatized, and it would have affected me in a way where I don't just think I could have just went back out there and gave it. Like I wouldn't have had no focus. Like that would have taken the energy out of my body. And I'd have been like, coach, you know, I can't give you nothing right now, man. I'm thinking about my teammate. You know, you got to make a decision, because that is your family, you know, because about a month ago, a kid fell and hit his head at our gym in the tournament, and we just stopped the game. We was like, game over with. That's it. There ain't, you know, we got, you know, this kid got to go to the hospital, and we're not going to play the game. So there ain't no question. Then we just made sure all the players left the building. So all the people in the building were the directors, and when the ambulance got there, you know, so I just thought it was tough to put your players in that situation. And probably if he were to do it all over again, they probably wouldn't have finished that game off, because at the end of the day, it's not about that game.
Mm-mm, not at all. So definitely hope he is able to continue to recover. And this is still something you got to watch long term,
because
we don't know yet, because this is the other phase of it. If you have it and recover, well, what's still happening with this cardiovascular stuff that could be a problem, you know?
So yeah. And I think a lot of athletes who have gotten it, you know, they probably got to go through a protocol of maybe getting physicals, you know, more often than not, you know, because if that could happen to him, and you know, we look at him, he's a specimen, man. I mean, solid across the board, great size, big time athlete. And if it could happen to him, like no one is invincible to having the COVID and then trying to recover from it. Because even if, you know, when Cam Newton never was the same, you know, even watching Lamar Jackson on Monday night, I was like, you know, there were spurts. I'm like, he's still fast. Don't get me wrong. They still couldn't catch him. And he still was leading him in the dust. But you know, he was catching cramps and. You know, it does throw your rhythm off, because your body has gone through something that you know, you hadn't experienced probably your whole life. Because even with Lamar Jackson, he was saying in those 10 days, he said, I just slept a lot. He said, I was just tired the whole time. So you can't imagine at the height of your profession, man, you just all of a sudden I'm just tired. I don't know what's going on. My body's not reacting the same. And then you got to come back. And in your mind as an athlete, I have to get back left off. So just imagine how much energy you are exerting in your mind and your body trying to get back to that point. So then you're overexerting yourself. So there aren't any studies. We don't know. So that's what I'm saying that makes it difficult for me when I think about them is that, man, you know what? What about all the other kids that might have been affected? How are they feeling about this?
Mm-hmm. And last thing, man, I just got to backtrack, you know, because this was so good. We didn't get to squeeze it in last week. But Bam Adebayo getting his house, getting his mom a house. And then when you walk in the door, they got a picture frame up of the single wide trailer they used to live in North Carolina before he came to UK. So just to see how happy he was to be able to do that for his mom, raise him by herself, walk to work, work multiple jobs and work so hard, just, you know, and to, you know, for them to make it, and just a proud moment for him and for them, for sure.
Well, like I said, it's a great story for someone who loves the game like Bam, and just his work ethic that he put into it. You know, he wasn't just only doing this for himself. He was doing it for his mom. And when you carry that burden, it makes you work that much harder, because now you're not just, it's not my struggle, it's our struggle. Mm-hmm. And that's what moms do, man, when they're single parents, that they make ends meet. You know, they, you know, we can probably go down the line of so many single parents, or, you know, so many guys, entertainment, sports figures that came from, you know, that one parent, a single parent, and they made it. You know, sometimes that pushes you even harder, man, you know, because you feel like, man, the other parent might have given up on me, or they gave up on us. And so now when you step out there, you pissed, man. Like, it's a whole nother kind of anger that you have. And especially when you love your mom the way he loved his mom, man, it's like, man, you know what? I got you, mom. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of guy he was. I remember seeing him, like, maybe 2 or 3 years ago at the Derby, Kentucky Derby. And, you know, just seeing how much, you know, how he felt, man, just how humble he was, you know, just a big old dude that loved basketball. And when you can put yourself in position to take care of your mom, it speaks volume for just, you know, what she did as a single parent and how well she taught him, and him just staying humble, man, and being rewarded at the end.
Yeah. So congratulations to him, and proud of him to be able to do that, and for grinding the way he has, like,
yes,
you
sir.
Said, to show his dad that, look, well, you don't need us. We don't need you. I got you, your mom.
I look got us. I
did for her.
No doubt. Man, no doubt.
We got a bunch in today. Thanks to the legend, John T. Edge.
John T. Edge, man. I know from here, from Georgia, man. You know, just down in Oxford, Mississippi, coming up with some great ideas. You know, taking his frame of mind to NCC Network and them seeing his vision, man, and making it grow. You know, I think that's when I tell kids, you know, don't let anyone, you know, close the door on your dream. You have to believe in yourself. And even as you become, you know, in your 40s or 50s, don't mean you still can't be successful. You know, and that's one thing that just watching what John T does with him and Wright is that, you know, they collaborate, they think about it, and they go to these small towns and they give people hope. You know, they let people know, like, small town America, you know, they get it done as well. You know, it's not going to be glamorous. It's not going to be the fame and all the lights that comes with it. But what they know is you see the love, you see the dedication, and you see people who enjoy a small town.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait to, which everybody in Brownsville already watched the show, you and everybody, you know, and I can't wait till everybody listens to us talking about the show from Brownsville. And of course, everybody, don't forget Lots of Rain, our buddies Dave and Ben doing that. Definitely go to Lots of Rain as they continue to sponsor the podcast. And there's always Up on the Sea of Blue. And of course, Believe.com, Believe Podcast Network, bringing all this to you. So appreciate all that. And just keep checking out the episodes, get yourself a watch, listen to this episode, and we'll still be here. If the cats turn around, cats struggle, we'll be here talking about it every week.
We will. All right, people, enjoy, happy holidays, and if you don't hear from us, Merry Christmas.
Absolutely. Subscribe, rate, review. We'll see y'all next time on Believe in Kentucky.
Deuces.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.